back to House of Comments with two rather dishevelled and tired hosts. I'm Charlotte Henry, and she, even more dishevelled than me, is Emma Bunnell. How are you?
I'm okay.
You're still standing?
Just about. It's been a hell of a week.
You've had a very busy week. I got to be part of a little bit of your busy week because I went to see a play you contributed to writing, which I really enjoyed. It was over in Kentish Town. I believe, well, tell people, didn't I see you're doing a couple more performances of it?
We are. So it was never the original plan. It was always going to be a one and done thing. But the whole thing turned out, given that it was literally the project, the idea was to write, produce, and put on a play in 48 hours. So we started on Saturday morning with one bit of video that was going to tie it all together. And that was it. And then we literally wrote it and produced it. And my brilliant friend David directed it. Incredible cast, put it all together. And it was, it was enormous fun to do. But as it turned out, and I hope I'm not blowing my own trumpet too much here, it was enormous fun to watch.
Oh, it was. I had a right laugh. I was sitting with you and your mate, and we had a right laugh. I was seriously impressed. So the premise was, it was a play called 48. You'd put it on, as you say, put it all together in 48 hours and then put on a couple of performances. I was blown away that you could have done it in such a short period of time, and that the actors remembered everything you said. They were very impressive.
Incredible. So brilliant.
So it's at, you can follow Emma on social media and she'll let you know where you can buy tickets for the next couple of
My pinned tweet has a link to tickets. So it's going on again on the 3rd and 4th of July, I believe. So come along. Honestly, we've got cabbages and time travel and a weft engine and the best sea shanty you will ever see.
I know, it was a right laugh. We had a really good time. I was very, very impressed. And then you went and did a TEDx talk the next day when I was
the
trying to tell you go to you.
I did a TEDx talk. So yeah, this has been a hell of a week.
Yeah. Well, what better way to end it than discussing Boris Johnson, COVID and Brexit?
Yeah, thanks, Charlotte.
Yeah.
Back down to earth with a bump.
Yeah, sorry. But these are the big stories of the week. The first thing then we should talk about is on Wednesday, so Keir Starmer wrote a op-ed, an opinion piece for The Express. Now, I could do a whole thing on the media significance of that, but I suspect most of our highly intelligent and engaged listeners will have picked up on it already. And the subject he wrote about for The Express was Brexit for The Express. I read the op-ed. The truth is, I'll get your take on it as a Labour member in a minute, but the truth is, and I'm, as we've made clear on this show a number of times, I'm a pretty diehard Remainer. I thought it was a disastrous decision to leave the EU. But at this stage that we're in June 2023, there wasn't that much I could find to disagree with Sir Keir in this piece. Let me just have a bit. He says, let me spell it out simply. Britain's future is outside the EU, not in the single market, not in the customs union, not with a return to freedom of movement. Now, just because I like all those things that he lists, and he very obviously likes all those things that he lists, that doesn't mean democratically you have a right to barge them through when we lost. And I would love to click my fingers and go back to 2016 and Remain win the referendum, but it ain't happening. Maybe you could write a play in which that does happen. Maybe your time travel in your play could sort that out for us, but it ain't
happening. West engine.
Yeah, exactly. It isn't happening. And his criticism of the government's handling of Brexit is also correct, because I mean, part of it is that many of the people at the top of government advocated for Brexit in a manner that could never work.
Yeah.
It was implausible. And yes, we can get all excited about the Australia-New Zealand free trade deal and all the rest of it. But what they wanted really could only lead us to the place we were here. We didn't talk about Northern Ireland enough during the campaign, and we are where we are. And he said, it's no great secret that I voted Remain, but as I went round the country, I found plenty to agree with Leave voters about. No matter how people voted, they wanted a better health service, better jobs, better wages, more security, a sense of control of their lives and communities. In short, a chance to build a better Britain. I don't. What was your take on it as a Labour? I've heard a lot of talk this week of people getting all up in arms. Oh, it's more Starmer flip flopping. It's a huge change. Is it? I don't. No, I mean, I sort
of saying this for 18 months at least. That he's now written it down in a Brexit supporting newspaper hasn't changed the fact that this is exactly where we are and where we have been as a party for a very long time. You know, we have constantly said once we left the EU under the terms that we left under, i.e. no part of the single market or customs union, that that was where we were going to be for the foreseeable future. And that whatever Labour did, they had to manage those conditions. Now, I'm like you. I wish we hadn't left. Of course I do. I'm a Remainer. I'm in favour of free movement. I would love to see us go back into the customs union single market at some point. But let's be realistic about this. First of all, we don't get, as a country, to click our fingers and say that's what's going to happen. There would be, were we to try and attempt to do those things, quite a serious amount of negotiation, and whatever our relationship with Europe is in the future, it will never have the same conditions that we had when we were part of the European
Union. And of course, the crazy thing about how we left was we had the most favourable terms of membership of the whole EU.
Absolutely. We got to keep our own currency. Some people weren't in favour of that, but the vast majority were.
Yeah. There weren't many people by 2016 calling on us to join the euro.
No, exactly. We got to have opt-outs on various things.
Including Schengen, free movement.
Schengen, for example. So if we were to go back into the single market, we would have to accept Schengen. We'd have to accept free movement.
We'd probably have to move towards the euro.
Probably have to move towards the euro. I would have thought that would be a condition.
We wouldn't have the massive rebate we had.
We wouldn't have the massive rebate. So there is not a world, and I think too many Remainers forget this, where we just go back to where we were. Yeah. And so while, yes, the polling says more people now think Brexit was a mistake than don't,
yep,
that's not the same as lots of people agreeing to go back in under whatever the conditions would be. And no, I think there's a real, basically what Keir Starmer is demonstrating here is that Labour are actually better at politics than the Remain campaign, which is not unusual because the Remain campaign were bloody atrocious.
I was going to say, that's not that difficult.
No, exactly. And I just get so fed up with this unrealistic belief from people in their bubble, let's put it as bluntly as it is, mm-hmm, whose friends all agree with them, but don't actually do the hard yards on thinking about what that agreement would mean for those who don't.
Yeah, never mind. And we do have to set, you know, we live in a democracy and we have to accept. Look, I'm a Lib Dem. I'm pretty used to accepting that my side loses. But, you know, it's reasonable to accept that. The area I've been a bit wishy-washy on, I'm never sure what I quite think about it, and I've definitely changed my views back and forth over time, is a second referendum. And never mind me, because I'm not very important, but Sir Keir Starmer has clearly, over time, very much backed away from supporting a second referendum with Remain on the ballot. And I think that's where some of the criticism of him writing this piece comes from.
But
and
again,
that's not that unfair.
That before we left.
Mm.
I backed that before we left. I have reservations about having done that.
Hang on, wasn't this, correct me, like I'm very happy to be corrected. Didn't he speak to conference calling for that second referendum post Brexit?
I may be wrong, but I think it was before 2020, because remember we didn't have any.
So you think it's, but oh, fine. So having lost the referendum, but yeah, of course,
I mean,
which it has to be
from
fine.
2020 to last year, we didn't have conferences in person. Not year before last, we didn't have conferences in person.
Correct.
So I think that speech was while he was still Brexit minister rather than leader.
Yeah, the shadow Brexit minister. Yeah. Okay. Again, so, look.
Look, again, you.
Time can move on.
I do have reservations about having supported a second referendum, having spoken to so many people who genuinely feel insulted by that idea. I think it was my emotional backlash rather than my political head that was supporting that.
Yeah, I'm a bit back and forth on it as well, because I kind of thought there's an argument that, you know, democracy doesn't start. I've written a piece. If you look,
I've written the phrase "democracy is not a stop clock" about this. Over
yeah,
and, over
and if you Google, can be bothered to Google somewhere around the internet, there is a piece from me saying us Remainers have to accept we lost, and a second referendum doesn't solve anything, and that is the most, you know, I accept that democratically. I could put an argument forward as well that stuff changes, we have more information, blah 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 blah, and therefore you should have a second referendum. I think those on the Remain side, talking of the bad politics of the Remain campaign, I think those on the Remain side jumped in far, far too quickly with a call for a second referendum, and that made it, it just looked like bad losers.
Losers' consent.
It just looked like bad losers, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think the thing about Starmer's position now and what is interesting looking forward from it is that what this probably does is give him and Rachel Reeves and David Lammy and all of the other people in there the space to do more alignment with the customs union, to make it easier to trade with Europe in terms of certain rules and conditions that we set upon our own industries. Because it's saying, look, we're going to do this in order to be good trade partners rather than to join the customs union.
Yeah. His whole argument, if you read the piece, and of course I'll link to it in the show notes so you can, is I didn't vote for Brexit. I don't like Brexit, but it's happened. And this government have made it much worse than it needed to be. And it's mismanaged, and my Labour government can make it better. That's his argument.
Yeah.
I have to be honest, I don't really buy it, in the sense that I think the position we've been put in, simply, like, I'm not sure there's a version of Brexit that makes things all that much better. I'm not sure there's a magic political leader that can do that.
Okay, there's only so much better it can get, but I think better alignment will help. And there's so much anger with any sense of alignment, and also a sense from certain Brexiteers and Conservatives that that's not why they Brexited. They Brexited in order to have a very, very different economy and country, and they want to have deregulation. Now, Labour is not the party of deregulation, so we are able to have the political space to be a bit more regulatorily aligned.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Twice.
Yeah, it's interesting because that kind of Singapore on Thames thing was never what was offered in the campaign. I don't really, you know what, whatever, I don't want to relive the campaign.
Yeah.
But I never felt that that's what was ever on offer from the Brexit team. Here's what Sir Keir writes elsewhere in the piece. He says, there is no point pretending everything is working fine. The paper-thin Tory deal has stifled Britain's potential and hugely weighted trade terms towards the EU. Every day it isn't built upon, our European friends and competitors aren't just eating our lunch, they're nicking our dinner money as well. That's what he has to say. There's an interesting point you made me think of as you were talking about alignment, which is obviously in the Conservative Party, the bit you have to appease is the hard Brexiteer right, who, as you rightly say, will never accept anything that looks like alignment or cooperation, basically. I mean, I'm being a bit crude and crass, but it doesn't feel like I'm that far off from that truth. For Sir Keir, his problem is being accused of being a Brexiteer and the left sort of having a go at him for, doing the Tories' dirty work and supporting Brexit and all that kind of stuff. It's a different kind of balancing act he has to manage. I think it's possibly less severe in the Labour Party.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not,
No, don't get me wrong. There's plenty of factionalism in the Labour Party.
Really?
You'd be shocked at it. But the thing is, and the difference between where Labour is right now and where the Tories are right now, is that Labour's in the ascendancy and nothing disciplines a party like the fact that they might win. So, yeah, you've got noisy idiots, naming no Owen Joneses. But actually...
Send your complaints letter to Emma, not me.
Yeah, I won't see your tweets. I have good filters, so you tweet them. But there are... they are less and less important in the party. There is a small L liberal moderate faction who aren't reconciled and probably never will be to Brexit, but they're not going to vote Tory. They might vote Lib Dem, but if they do so, they'll do so in a seat where Labour's got a 12,000 majority. It won't make much of a difference.
Or a seat where Labour couldn't win anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And in which case, Labour would be very happy for them to vote Lib Dem.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one to see how this plays out. There hasn't been much of a backlash to it. Maybe that is because you're right and it hasn't. Nothing very much has changed.
No, this is yet another one of those examples where Twitter noise and real life are just so complete.
Sure, that's a given at this stage. So, yeah, well, let's move on from Brexit because I can't really deal with it anymore.
If only people would.
Yeah, and that's, to be fair, to Sir Keir, and I try not to be, obviously, as you know.
Obviously, because you hate him and you're
a... Yeah, I don't actually. I don't at all. I think he's not very interesting. Not particularly compelled by him. I don't think there's any all that much wrong with him either. He's a bit flip-floppy, but which politicians
well,
aren't.
Well, and that really is the difference, isn't it, between now and 2019? Look.
Oh, yeah, I've said that.
Labour under Corbyn. I did so... I mean, I wrestled with it, even as a Labour member, because I was so aware of his flaws. But I think if you look at the general populace, while there were two reasons why 2019 was the defeat it was. One of them was Brexit, the other one was Corbyn. And Starmer has turned around the latter and is pretty successfully neutralising the former.
Yeah, I don't see the Labour Party tearing itself over Brexit in the way the Conservatives periodically do. Whatever I think of any of those involved, I don't see that happening.
No, and it's fascinating, isn't it? Because this was supposed to close the argument in the Conservative Party, and it really, really hasn't.
No, but remember, Emma, we've never tried doing Brexit properly.
Like communism.
Never been tried properly. Okay. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let's do it. COVID. This is week two of the row over the COVID public inquiry, and the government is taking its own inquiry to court.
Week two, and they're taking themselves to court. I mean, well,
I don't think it's actually week two. It's week two that we've discussed it. Let's be
Yeah, but I mean, we haven't actually even got to the hearings yet.
No, but they're going to take. Yeah, someone tweeted the timeline. I couldn't believe it. It was like 2025. Isn't the care homes bit 2025? I think it was Sam Coates from Sky that tweeted out.
I mean, this is going to be ongoing for a really, really... It's going to be the background noise of politics. Now, I'm right...
Do you think so? I want to get into the specifics of what's happened this week, but since you've raised it, do you think there is a point where everyone goes, this was so... Like, I think it's different for individual cases, like we've discussed when, like, Partygate comes up again and all that stuff. But I think there is a point with a big inquiry like this where people go, this was so awful. It's please, 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 we hope, quote, you know, over to the best it can ever be with a pathogen. I don't want to hear about it anymore. Sort yourselves out. Go away.
Think about
particularly if it's like 2024, 2025.
Think about Hillsborough.
Yes, yes.
Hillsborough. There were fewer than 100 people who died.
Yeah.
And the fight for justice was rightly noisy, rightly ongoing, and lasted a very long time and built up its profile over time. You know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people died, some of them unnecessarily due to COVID. And yes, because of the impact on the rest of us was so devastating to our mental health, to our lives, that we have moved away from thinking about it. There is a difference, but those people and their righteous anger is not going to go away. And their fight for justice is not going to go away. I'm writing a piece for my newsletter this weekend about what we could and should want from this inquiry, because my concern at the moment is that there's an awful lot of process stories and coverage of what of poor behaviour from the government. And that is going to be interesting to the vast majority of journalists covering the inquiry. What we actually need from this inquiry is how to learn lessons for the next big pandemic, because that ultimately would be what the most important thing. Yes, we need justice for the victims. Yes, we need to know what happened, what went wrong, and who's to blame. But we can't lose in all of that the importance of learning the lessons of what went wrong and thinking about how to take those forward for what happens next. And I'm really, really concerned that that is where we're going to end up.
What, because we just focus on the process of the inquiry and a row, a political row?
We focus on all the political rows and the Partygate, obviously, huge scandal, never should have happened. Quite right that it's been investigated. People should be punished for it. But the lessons learned have to be bigger than don't be a dick.
Right. Yeah, I don't disagree with any of this. I just wonder how much it will stay in the public consciousness and how much the anger will continue. But I think I can't argue at all with your point that people who feel that they lost a loved one who could have been saved, who, you know, got trapped in a care home, who couldn't get the treatment they needed that would have kept them alive, all that kind of stuff, all the terrible stuff we know was happening at the beginning, particularly. Yes, you're absolutely right. Obviously, people need to make sure our pandemic response is better in the future, because maybe one of the things the inquiry will learn is that our pandemic response weren't very well prepared.
Well, we abandoned our pandemic strategy.
Like, all that stuff must be discussed. Yeah. I'm going to get slightly in trouble for this, but I would also like some of the inquiry, at least, to deal with the facts of the costs and benefits of lockdown. Because I think that needs a serious, not political, not hand-waving, you know, from certain people discussion. I think it needs a proper evidence-based discussion.
I agree. I think there are real emotional implications of this.
Yes.
As you know, I suffered very severely with my mental health during lockdown.
And you and millions of others.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so not special.
You're very special, but the point is, but it's important because you and millions of others. That's my point.
I raise this is not to say, so when I go on to various lockdown skeptical programs that I do on a regular basis, and they're railing against it, my emotional reaction is not this shouldn't have happened to me, but my sacrifice is being demeaned here.
Yeah, that's also...
And I think that's an underrated factor in the politics of lockdown.
Yep, you might well be right about that. I just think all of that needs a very serious discussion, as does everything else.
As I say, if we're going to do lessons learned so that we have better plans for the future, I mean, one of those lessons learned might have been if we'd shut down quickly, we'd have shut down less.
Yep.
But again, what's essential is to take my emotions, as much as anybody else's emotions, out of it and come up with a plan for the future that has proper, robust evidence taken from this.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're...
Lots of politicking over never shut down again or shut down completely immediately.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. Take my, the anger some people felt, and I think you could film my tweets where I was pretty cross about lockdown at various points. We need to do all that without the anger that happened and the emotion that happened in the middle of it. You know, what were the consequences for cancer waiting lists? You know, all the costs and benefits of what happened during that time. And you are absolutely right that it has to take the emotion out of it. It has to, and be evidence-based. That was a slight diversion from what we were going to talk about, because what we were going to talk about is the politicking that you cited. And that's... So Boris Johnson has now handed over a bunch of what seem to be very messy and scrappy notebooks and a phone, a set of WhatsApp messages. I don't know if he's given over the physical phone, I doubt it, to the COVID inquiry. Now, those messages from Boris Johnson are only from May 2021 onwards.
I think I've just seen a news alert that says he's giving up everything now. Boris Johnson says he will now give his unredacted WhatsApp messages directly to the COVID inquiry 14 minutes ago from the BBC. So,
yes, I can see. Okay,
so in the Cabinet Office to give it directly to the inquiry.
The messages received, yes, and you're quite right. Those messages received before April 21 would be likely to cover discussions about coronavirus lockdowns implemented in 2020, according to the BBC story that is breaking live as we record House of Comments. What I wanted to talk about when I wrote this is I don't want to go back and forth on really on what, lockdowns and what Boris Johnson did and all of that. I want to talk about what he's doing now, which seems to me just blatant politicking. He thought he could get away with leaving, later WhatsApp messages and, all that stuff about, basically, I assume it's a lot of, well, hey, we've got the vaccine, isn't everything going great? All of that stuff from May 2021 onwards. When frankly, it's the earlier stuff, in some ways, it's much more important. And it's very interesting to me that as soon as the government has decided to judicial review the inquiry, he's gone, here you go, everything.
I think the thing with Boris is he doesn't... This is going to sound ungenerous. Of course, I have my biases about Boris Johnson, but genuinely trying to think of him as a political actor, you have to take the evidence that he doesn't do anything outside of playing a game with all of us. His current biggest opponent is Rishi Sunak, because he's the guy who, in his mind, brought him down. There's no sense that Boris Johnson might have been brought down by Boris Johnson.
Oh, no, it was never his fault.
But I think we're in a real... there are so many different factors and so many different actors. And the problem is, and it's the same problem America's having with Trump, that we've existed in a political world where whatever you thought of the policies they pursued, the parties of government were there to enact a policy agenda. And Boris Johnson and Donald Trump are not there primarily to enact a policy agenda. That's not what motivates them. It's not what drives them. What drives them is their own power and position.
Their egos.
Their egos. And we are not set up as a society, as a political functioning organization, to cope with that, because all of our structures are set up to work around and enact policy, not to work around and enact the raising of an individual.
Yes, particularly here in the UK, where we don't have a presidential system.
Yeah.
Just back to these Boris Johnson messages. Here is the letter he has sent, I believe, to the chair of the committee. I have asked that the Cabinet Office pass these to you. If the government chooses not to do so, I will ask for these to be returned to my office so that I can provide them to you directly.
Yeah.
Basically, again,
I mean, he's... it is extraordinary that A, he is trying to make out that he's the good guy here.
Yes.
But even more extraordinary is how stupidly the government have allowed that space for him to do that to happen.
I just keep saying yes because I can't think of much to disagree with or debate or add.
Just yet another grist for my Rishi Sunak's really bad at politics argument.
Oh, yeah, which I like Rishi Sunak more than you do, but I've consistently said he's not very good at small P politics.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to see how this plays out because there is a long way to go in this inquiry. This is not the last time we're going to hear about the inquiry interacting with Boris Johnson. There isn't much more we can say because this is just the beginning of the process in terms of getting the evidence and so on. Maybe if we're still doing this show in 2025, 2026, we'll be able to do a special on everything that's come out from the inquiry. But
you
for now...
You'll have to listen to every episode and say take out every clip about it and see what we got right and wrong.
I look forward to you doing that. but this is just going to be an ongoing process, and Boris Johnson continues to play games with something. And actually, you would think he would have the humanity, never mind the humility.
Would I think that? Would I?
One would like to think that he could deal with something so serious and take it with the seriousness it deserves. But him, and to some extent, given this judicial review nonsense, the government are not treating it with the seriousness it deserves. And that is particularly grotesque. We've got another horrible story to end on. We're going to come back. We'll try and do something nice next week. But Labour MP Gareth Davis has been suspended over serious allegations of unacceptable behaviour. We're putting this at the end of the show because basically there isn't much we can say because there isn't all that much we know.
No, there isn't much we know. And obviously we want to be very cautious about what we do and don't say.
Right, so.
I asked that we raise this because I wanted to be clear that I will never duck these topics when it's my own party.
And also... I'm going to say it. The Politico story has as its tagline, Gareth Davis, 63, is accused of targeting women as young as 19. Allegedly, we don't know. We have to let the process play out. Allegedly, right?
And process, I want to pick up on that word.
Because
please. Here's the biggest problem. None of the political parties, none of them, have decent, proper complaints processes.
Right.
Kind of thing.
And this list
has abjectly failed to learn lessons over the last 5 years on this, abjectly failed on it. And, you know, have rejected recommendations from up to and including in the Ford report for there to be an independent complaints process. And as long as that doesn't exist, this behaviour will continue.
You lead me nicely to the point I want to make on this. Here's a line from this Politico story that Esther Weber and Agnes Shambra wrote. I'm sorry, Agnes, if I pronounced your name wrong. It says, many of the alleged incidents took place on the parliamentary estate, sometimes in bars or after late night votes. One of the women he allegedly targeted was just 19 years old at the time. And this is what goes to the core of these problems in politics. There are older men who, rightly or wrongly, young staff, see as powerful and their route through the system. And it is, I'm going to pick my words very carefully. It is all too easy, not for this individual, for male MPs in general, senior male staff in general, to take advantage of them. Unfortunately, this is not the first story we have heard like this. You know, some have gone all the way through the process and been proven. Some have not been proven. We don't know how this particular incident is going to go. The point is, the way the political system is set up leaves younger women very vulnerable to this kind of behaviour.
And young men, to be fair.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
You know me, I'm the staunchest feminist going, but I do.
No, you're absolutely right.
It's vulnerable young people.
ambitious, tried to get through politics. And as in many industries, there are always people willing to take advantage of that. And in politics, it's very hard to deal with that and get justice if you are a victim of this. Does that sound fair?
Yes. I also think there is the added complication of the idealism of politics. You go into politics to support a cause. You know, the same thing happens in the third sector. Whereas if you're in a business and this happens, you're not that wedded to the business as a cause. If, on the other hand, you're trying to cure cancer or poverty in the third world, or have a socialist government elected, you have the added pressure of not damaging the cause as much as not damaging your own career or the person that you admire.
Yeah, and politics is also a team sport element to it, where you want anyway. We obviously, as I keep saying, these are all allegations. We don't know how any of this is going to play out, but it's a good point to raise some of the issues that can arise in politics. End us on something happy, Emma.
Come and see my play. It's really right. Funny.
Okay, well, that'll do. You're Emma Bunnell. Where can people keep up with you?
You can find me on Twitter at @EmmaBunnell_, and you could read my newsletter on Substack, which is Hard Thinking on the Soft Left.
I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on Twitter, and head over to theaddition.net for my blog, for my newsletter, for far too much from me. I'm at Charlotte A. Henry across social media, or at Charlotte A. Henry. You can follow House of Comments at HOC Podcast on Twitter as well.
That's what you'd like. Tell us your happy stories for this week. But also you, the listener.
Oh, yeah, please. Send us something lovely to cheer us up. And actually, as a general point, if there's something you want us to discuss on the show, do send us a tweet, because we always love to hear from you. But until then, see you next week.